Hey everyone, Steve Adubato. This is Lessons in Leadership with my co-anchor, our executive producer, Mary Gamba. Hey Mary, we've been talking a lot about media leadership or leadership in the media or lack of leadership in the media these days. And we have an interview coming up with Jeff Kanige, who is the editor at NJ Biz, our media partner. Why is that interview important?
It's so important. We have been talking about Media Matters. This is part of our Media Matters mini-series, if you will. And it's also part of the bigger Adubato Center for Media Leadership. Adubato.
What is that?
I'm going to put it up right now, adubatomedialeadership.org. Sylvester is going to put that on the bottom of the screen.
When did that happen?
It was one of your ideas that really took off, and it's just been really a lot of fun. So you can log onto the website and see media leaders like Jeff and others talking about what we need more from today, from our leaders in media, and what that looks like. So the interview that you're going to see in just a moment with you and Jeff, you just kind of touch the tip of the iceberg on what we need in media leadership today.
Yeah, Bob, P.S., the Adubato Center for Media Leadership, funded privately by our family, the Adubato family. And my son, Stephen, who is a terrific journalist, is involved as well. Usami Tuniger, who is the co-executive producer of that podcast series called Media Matters. Check out our website, as Mary said, adubatomedialeadership.org. But the whole idea is, I love when people say, oh, so you have a podcast so you can express your opinion. I love my friend Chris Cuomo. Chris is great, but sometimes I wonder, why is the entire podcast Chris? Meaning, I like talking to other people. Yes, I'll express my opinion, but it's more important that we have people like, nah, Cuomo's going to be pissed. Okay. Jeff Kanize, I like talking to other media leaders, how they're dealing with things, particularly he's in business media. We're not. So Jeff Kanize, the editor of NJ Biz, talks about media leadership, the economics of media, running a media organization these days, being an editor, all that stuff. Really important stuff. Chris, don't be upset because we're going to want you as a guest soon. Check it out. We're now joined by our good friend and media colleague, Jeff Kanize, who's editor at a great publication, NJ Biz. Good to see you, Jeff.
Thanks for having me.
You know what? You're way more than a publication. As we put up your website, tell everyone what NJ Biz is and why this is part of our Media Matters series, why it matters more than ever.
Well, we do have a publication, a weekly newspaper. We also have a website, njbiz.com, and we produce a series of events pretty much once a month, awards events, recognition events, things like that. What we do is we focus like a laser on New Jersey businesses. We give business owners, corporate executives, the information they need to make better decisions about investments, about hiring, about expansion or contraction. What we try to do is give these folks all the information they need to run their businesses in a better way. It's been tough for that kind of information. As I'm sure you know, daily newspapers are cutting back as around the state, around the world, around the country. So we think we're providing the kind of information that they really can't get anywhere else.
Along those lines, Jeff, this is, as I said, part of our series, Media Matters, and staying in any one place doesn't work, meaning constantly evolving, which NJ Biz does every day. And they're one of our longtime media partners. We created, as I mentioned to you offline, the Adubato Center for Media Leadership, privately funded a family foundation to look at media leadership, which is what this is a part of. And the website will come up for the center. Here's the question. Is, from your perspective, Jeff, you just talked about it's a print publication, it's digital, it's got a website, we have all these events, we have awards. Is media leadership in 2026 dramatically different than media leadership would have been in 2016?
I have to believe that's true. I mean, well, 2016, yes. I mean, you're still talking about there was the
2010.
Okay, yes. Because back in 2010, you didn't have all these podcasts, influencers, digital media, digital video. Multimedia was something that we were just starting to get into, if I recall correctly, when I was working in New York at the time. So yes, I mean, there's a lot more competition, even though print publications have been pulling back. You have all of this competition from digital. It doesn't take that much, as you know, to put up a website and to start producing videos and to start sending out information. And a lot of that, you know, a lot of the information is misinformation, disinformation. It's very difficult to know what you're getting. And yes, it's far more difficult in the face of all of that to convince people that what you're presenting to them is information that they need and that they can use and rely on.
But the other side of that, Jeff, that I often think about, and you're on the editorial side, and some of us in media leadership are on the editorial side, but we're also, on the business side, meaning no money, no mission. In our not-for-profit leadership, excuse me, media organization, if we don't bring in sponsors, if we don't bring in underwriters, there's no programming. So here's my question: how much of media leadership in these very challenging times is really financial media leadership?
Actually, almost all of it. I mean, what we're told constantly is that everything that we do, we're all involved in generating revenue. We all have to take that as part of our job to generate revenue because it's very difficult to traditional sources don't provide it anymore. So we have to be constantly every day thinking about, okay, this is a great thing for us to do. Are we going to be able to monetize it? Can we get the kind of revenue for it that will make it worth our while, worth our time to do that? So it's a huge part of what we do now.
I often think about the next generation of media leaders, and part of this Adubato Center for Media Leadership puts aside money for scholarships for students in the college level going into media and journalism who are challenged by paying for their tuition. That being said, I often wonder when I've taught at different universities, media, journalism, communications, and I think back on those courses I taught, I never really talked about the economics of media and journalism. I think it's more important when you think. For younger people going into our profession, whatever the heck that means, do you think they say, no, I just want to be a journalist. I just want to be on the editorial side. I want to write. I want to report. I want to do investigative reporting. I want to do business reporting. I don't want to be involved on the business side. Do you really have that luxury?
I don't think so. I really don't. Back in, talk about 2010, 2016, when the internet and online sources became much more prevalent, we started to be told as reporters and editors that one thing we had to do to make sure that we were successful was to develop our personal brand and make ourselves into essentially a
Yes.
profit center, a business, a revenue generating organism, if you will, to because that's the only way you can survive. As you say, if there's no money, there's no publication, there's no website,
How hard was
there's
that? I'm sorry for
nothing.
interrupting, Jeff. Because, by the way, go on the njbiz.com website. You'll see so many interviews. Jeff does one-on-one interviews, features. He did one on us a while back, but he also does these great panel discussions on all sorts of issues. Check that out. How challenging was it, or is it, for you, Jeff, to be the brand?
Well, it's something that I'm used to. I've been doing it for a long time, actually, dating back to my time as when I was working in New York. I was at a publication called The Deal, which covered mergers, acquisitions, bankruptcy, private equity, things like that. It was acquired by TheStreet.com, which was more of a investor focused website, and I was editor in chief there for a while too. At that point, when I was editor in chief of TheStreet.com, I was also, an executive of the company. I was in board meetings and I was part of the budget process. All of those things, you can't get away from it now. Not everybody's involved, and our staff is as involved as I am. Why don't I go to more meetings than anybody else does? So there's that. But I come back from those, and we have our planning staff meetings, and a lot of the discussion is on the kinds of things that we can do to help generate revenue and to help keep the company afloat.
Question about media independence. This is an interesting, and it's not a theoretical or abstract question for those of us who are, again, involved on the business side, bringing in money, but also having to do the editorial. That being said, our partners in public broadcasting for years significantly dependent upon government funding and private foundation individual sources. But when the administration in Washington says, we're done, we're out. Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which is the pass-through, if you will, from the federal government to public broadcasting stations, we're out. Here's the question. To what, not to mention corporate sponsors and corporate underwriters, people that say, well, they don't have any influence. It's just there's a line, there's a church and state. I get all that. But there's also partnerships, collaboration, and in all candor, there's programming we do that we know our underwriters care about. Do they control the content? No. But hospitals care about healthcare programming, translation. How the heck, it's a long-winded way to get to this. How the heck do you keep your journalistic independence while being involved on the business side? Because I find it challenging at times.
It is challenging because you're always tempted to if you're having to choose, because again, I'm sure you're aware too, resources have been pulling back. Our staff is smaller now than it was before the pandemic. We don't have a lot of leeway and there's no fat at all. So when you're talking about deciding what you're going to spend time on and who's going to do what, part of what your calculus is this going to result in, is it worth it to produce the kind of revenue and is it worth our time to do this, even if it sounds like it's a great story? Fortunately, our company is committed to doing good journalism, and so that is always front and center of what we do. I don't know that that's the case everywhere. I hope it is. And I think at some places the lines are blurrier than they are in other places. You talk about years ago, I would never have thought when I first started out that it would be like this, that it would get to this, that separation that you talked about, that was a real thing. That was something that we felt, that we talked about. It was like a brick wall that could not be breached. And now, as you say, you have to be a business person too. You can't just sort of be pure as the driven snow. You have to worry about where the money's coming from.
P.S., not to mention there are owners of certain media organizations who step in on the editorial side and say, yeah, that endorsement you were going to do of that candidate, that's not happening. You know the programming we have, you know the department we have that covers XYZ, that's going away. Who's making that decision? The person who controls the money, the owner, the publisher. I'm off my soapbox. That's Jeff Knaish. He's a great editor at our partners at NJ Biz, our media partner. You can also, not only will this be seen on Lessons in Leadership, but also on our public television broadcasting, but also on the Adubato Center for Media Leadership. Go check it out. Hey, Jeff, cannot thank you enough. We look forward to future conversations about being a leader in the media in these challenging times. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you, Steve.
You got to stay with us. We'll be right back. This edition of Lessons in Leadership is made possible by the Buccino Leadership Institute at Seton Hall University, Prager Metis, Valley Bank, the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 825, NJ Transit, the North Ward Center, O'Toole Scrivo, Gingoli Construction, the New Jersey Sharing Network, Delta Dental of New Jersey, The Helix, Fedway Associates Inc., the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, Choose New Jersey, and Seton Hall University, inspiring great minds to greater purpose since 1856.
This is Mary Gamba. If you want more leadership tips and tools, log on to stand-deliver.com. That's stand-deliver.com.
Promotional support for this edition of Lessons in Leadership with me, Steve Adubato, and my colleague, Mary Gamba, has been provided by NJ.com, NJBIA and New Jersey Business Magazine, CIANJ and Commerce Magazine, and the Meadowlands Chamber and Meadowlands Media.
A dream is just a dream. Until your ambition ignites it. Pursuing your legacy takes drive, resilience, and a financial partner who not only sees your vision for your future, but who will go all in with you and focus your ambitions for what you hunger to achieve next.
Back again by popular demand, our good friend Dr. Jose Azar, Executive Vice President, Chief Quality and Clinical Service Line Officer at Hackensack Meridian Health. Good to see you, Jose.
Good to see you too, Steve.
You got it. Briefly describe your role. By the way, you're also a professor of medicine, Hackensack Meridian School of Medicine, Department of Hematology Oncology, Hackensack Meridian Health. Outside of the School of Medicine, describe your role at HMH.
Yes, I have two roles. They really focus on one thing: how do we deliver the best care to our patients? So I lead quality, making sure that every patient gets the best outcomes they can in the safest way possible. I also lead the service lines, which are basically a way for us to organize all the services that a patient needs in a cohesive and integrated way.
Love it. Now, you and I were having this conversation the other day about the Agile Institute. Yes. What the heck is the Agile Institute, and what does it have to do with the delivery of healthcare? This is part of our series, Leaders in Healthcare. Dr. Azar, Agile Institute.
Yeah, I know. It's a mouthful, right?
Go ahead.
Let me explain it to you in a relatable way. Imagine a patient with congestive heart failure. Imagine a patient with cancer. And I'm going to ask two questions. The first one, what outcomes do they want? And the second, how do they want their doctor, their nurse, their clinical team to function, right? So let's start with the second one. I imagine that a patient would want their doctor, their nurse, to be empowered to shape the way they are able to deliver care to them. And that's the main purpose of the Agile Institute, empowering the doctors to allow them to have a say in the way we organize care so that patients can get the services they need in a timely way, which leads to the second part, which is, what do patients want? They want the best outcomes. They want the best research. They want to have the best chance to, if they have a cancer, to survive it, and to survive it with the best health. If they have congestive heart failure or heart condition, they want the best chance to have their goals met, meaning being functional and being able to live their life well. And that's the outcomes we want to give them in the most innovative and up-to-date way.
And hard to do that in the current environment with the current constraints and culture. And that's why some changes need to be made. Is that fair to say, Jose?
That is very fair to say. It's very challenging to do in an environment that is pulling the doctors, the nurses away from their mission, which is taking care of human beings. And it's not because they don't want to do that. And it's not because somebody evil is trying to do that. But we've stacked a lot of different processes. We've stacked a lot of different technology in place that added burdens to the patient and the doctor relationship. So imagine this. I'm sure you've gone to the doctor. I've gone to the doctor.
Yeah, too often, by the way. I go way too quickly.
I know, more than we want to, right? So think about it this way. How does a doctor sit with you, and how do they interact with you? Most of the time, they're sitting in front of a computer, barely looking at you. We don't want that. You don't want that. Don't want that. Doctors and nurses don't want that. They want this, exactly. And that's what we want to empower them to be able to do with technology, right? To relieve that burden. The things that they're putting on the computer are very important things. But is the doctor the best person to do that? Or can we get technology to do that?
Interesting. Mary, jump in here.
Dr. Azar, talk a little bit more about that technology. I often bring up here, The Pitt is one of my favorite TV shows. And on The Pitt, yes, they were using that exact technology where the chief of staff came in and said, I'm going to have the cell phone in there. So as the patient's explaining their ailment. But as you just mentioned, in that situation, the technology did make a lot of mistakes. So how are you going to, with utilizing the technology to make that human connection, how are you going to link then the making sure that the correct information is being transcribed by that technology?
Correct. And that brings me back to why we need to empower our doctors and nurses to shape the way we deliver care. None of this technology should be done to the doctors or the nurses. It should be done with them. And so that's the concept of co-design, meaning the technology is developed, but we engage our doctors and our nurses, those who are at the bedside delivering care, not me who's sitting in an office, but those who are at the bedside. They need to shape it and form it in a way that serves their need, because they know best what patients need, right? And so we engage in co-design the way we design technology and the way we institute or implement technology in the real world, in their clinical world, with them. So that's what I mean by they're empowered. One more point. I also want to say technology is learning, and we want our doctors and nurses to help train it to be able to meet their expectation and their specifications. So you're right. The technology may not have been optimal upfront, but we always make sure that the doctors and nurses have oversight. And then that oversight will allow them to allow the technology to self-correct and learn so that it optimizes over time to become better and better at meeting their expectations and their need and being
Mary,
more
I'm gonna, oh, sorry, Jose, I'm gonna complicate things, Mary. Mary just asked a great question. By the way, I tried to watch The Pitt a couple of times and I couldn't get past some of the scenes.
It's my favorite show and they do it so well.
You can tell me about it, Mary. I just can't, my stomach can't handle it. It's a little, I'm squeamish, but here's the thing I'm curious about. Mary brings up a great issue that you followed up on, Dr. Azar, and it's technology. But I want to complicate things. AI, part of technology, right? Evolving, work with it. And by the way, check out the interview we did with our good friend, Greg Lalavi. It's on our website right now on artificial intelligence. Yeah. I'm going to tweak this. AI, not that. EQ, emotional intelligence. Here's the question. Yeah. Do you believe that this thing called emotional intelligence, Dr. Azar, mostly empathy, the ability to see how we're seen by others, the ability to try to relate to others and understand our audience as we're communicating with them, all those things and so much more. From a leadership perspective in healthcare, to what degree do you think it's either you have it or you don't, and you can't learn it because it's innate, or something else? Go ahead.
Yeah, I believe that it's a skill to learn.
You do?
I do, very firmly. I also believe not only is it a skill to learn, it is the most important skill to learn in this day and age. And let me tell you why.
Please.
AI will beat any human in its IQ, intelligence quotient, right? There is no human that's going to be able to compute as fast as AI. There's no human that's going to be able to recall information as fast as AI or integrate information as fast as AI. As far as we know so far, AI has not been able, it may be able one day, but at least for now, it's on intelligence, but not emotion. I think humans can relate to humans a lot more effectively. And I think that what excites me about AI, especially AI in healthcare, is the following. I think AI is going to unburden the distractions that we have. Me filling up a computer. Me as a leader responding to emails and texts while I'm sitting with you leading you. If I take all that burden to the side, I can be a human fully present with you as another human. And I can leverage my emotional quotient and my emotional intelligence to connect better with you, whether I'm a clinician connecting with a patient, or I'm a leader connecting with another person or another leader that I'm leading, right? If I unburden all the distractions, I think that's what gets in our way from truly being the best humans.
This is a distraction. This is a distraction.
It's a distraction. It's important. There are important things that are happening in that, but if I can unburden those automatic, tasky things, I think it's going to elevate our human experience to connect at a deeper level. But that's like anything. If you ask me, can you run a marathon tomorrow? No. But can I train to run a marathon? Absolutely, yes. EQ is the same way.
That's it. So it's not that you're born to run a marathon. You can train to run a marathon.
Yeah, there are some people who have more innate abilities than others, but everybody can run a marathon if they want to.
You know, when someone says, I'm not a natural born leader, I'm not a natural born, I don't have natural. Mary, don't be saying.
You know, I was going to empathy if we had more time.
I'm going to let you go, Dr. Azar. Are we ready for this? This is Mary Gamba in the last 2 years. My empathy button is shut off. And it's just not true. She likes to say it. But she
it's
can't
more,
hide
it's
it.
It's more patience and tolerance.
Yes.
Mary, you're the only one who can unshut it off and turn it
I know.
Off.
I'm working on that, Dr. Azar.
I believe you can.
You.
I believe you can. And
Mary,
thank you.
Your empathy button is not off. That's just not true.
Yeah. And that's really the essence of the Agile Institute, by the way, Steve.
Go ahead.
Human connectivity. We study and train how to influence behavior as a leadership skill. That's the core of what we do.
By the way, Mary, I know you didn't follow up to say anything because you're seeing in the cues that says we have 3 minutes left and we have a couple of final words. That was very well done.
I can talk about this all day, Dr. Azar. And if you are truly teaching this and you can try to fix me on this one because it's broken.
Well, Mary, then go. You know what? Let's not say goodbye to everyone. Let's stay with Dr. Azar.
I can't fix you if you don't want to be fixed. But if you want to engage in that.
No, and Steve, I'm glad that you said this. So we should. Dr. Azar, you're going to stay with us through the end of the show.
Stay with us for another couple of minutes. Go ahead, Mary.
Because I truly believe that there are many people out there in the universe like me. And it's not my empathy button. My empathy toward dogs and animals and it is through the roof. I empathize with them. What I don't have empathy for is, I don't know whether it's incompetence or lack of trying, and I don't have empathy for that. Or if I feel someone is, you know, not necessarily injured, you know, they're just hurt, I don't have any empathy for that. And so for the people watching out there, you talked about the Agile Institute teaching for this. What advice can you give those people who are like me and have a hard time empathizing for other humans?
Dr. Azar, before you answer, this is Mary's comment to me. Two things she says when I start complaining about whatever's going on. Two, she makes a baby. Mary, do the baby
sound. The little baby violin.
She'll do that. She'll go, wah, wah.
Wah. Baby.
Or she'll say, hey, put your big boy pants on. Mm-hmm. That's Mary. Go ahead, Dr. Azar.
Yeah. So I'm going to break it down to two parts.
Got a minute and a half left. Go ahead.
Yeah, you can't give empathy unless you have the energy to give empathy. It drains you. It drains all of us. So you got to start with, are you full so that you can extend to others? So that's the first part. Are you at peace yourself? Are you comfortable with where you are? Do you have enough energy inside you to be able to extend empathy? The second is, why do you empathy towards what? Why are you extending empathy? What's the ultimate point here? If you focus on what you're trying to achieve and why do you need to bring that person along, it will help you reframe your mind from it's that person against me to it's me and that person together accomplishing something bigger that none of us can achieve alone, right? And you don't want to fail and they don't want to fail. That will force you and that person to get out of themselves and understand the other person, which is basically what empathy is about. It takes a lot of energy, though. You can't do it if you're empty.
Mary, you're fixed.
I'm fixed. I'm cured. I have a ton of energy, Dr. Azar. I just don't want to give it to anyone else.
Stop.
Well, and that's the point. If you don't want to achieve anything, then don't give empathy.
I'm going to give it to dogs. We'll leave it at that, Steve.
She has empathy for animals. She has empathy for people. She just likes to say this. She's got tremendous empathy. Dr. Jose Azar from our partners at HMH. Thank you, Jose. Thank you, Mary, who's a very loving, caring leader and human being. See you next time. This edition of Lessons in Leadership is made possible by the Buccino Leadership Institute at Seton Hall University, Prager Metis, Valley Bank, the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 825, NJ Transit, the North Ward Center, O'Toole Scrivo, Gingoli Construction, the New Jersey Sharing Network, Delta Dental of New Jersey, The Helix, Fedway Associates, Inc., the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, Choose New Jersey, and Seton Hall University, inspiring great minds to greater purpose since 1856.
This is Mary Gamba. If you want more leadership tips and tools, log on to stand-deliver.com. That's stand-deliver.com.
Promotional support for this edition of Lessons in Leadership with me, Steve Adubato, and my colleague, Mary Gamba, has been provided by NJ.com, NJBIA and New Jersey Business Magazine, CIANJ and Commerce Magazine, and the Meadowlands Chamber and Meadowlands Media.
A dream is just a dream until your ambition ignites it. Pursuing your legacy takes drive, resilience, and a financial partner who not only sees your vision for your future, but who will go all in with you and focus your ambitions for what you hunger to achieve next.